Hello, I'm Lori Knight. This is number 0703, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0703. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet Vic Ferrari, a retired NYPD detective who has written a number of humorous books about the job, including NYPD Law and Disorder. How did this writing gig start for him?
I was bored out of my mind. I retired. I moved down to Florida. I went through some training. I became a police officer down in Florida for a short period of time. And that didn't work out. It's totally night and day between New York and Florida. Like down here, I had to spend a half a day learning how to wrestle alligators. I said, no, you know what? I could deal with criminals all day long. I'm not gator wrestling. I retired again. And it was out of necessity. I was bored out of my mind. And friends and family at their urging said, you got all these stories. Why don't you start writing them down? And I did. You know, it's led to a little cottage industry for me.
Professor Peter McNally on the current turmoil within the monarchy and the alleged battle between Prince William and Prince Harry.
Is there really a battle between them? I'm not really sure that there is so much. There's obviously friction between them. They've taken different paths. Whether it's actually gotten to the point of being a battle, I'm not really quite sure. We have two sons, one who is first in line of succession to the throne, and we know what his destiny is. The problem is, of course, is that the younger children, Queen Elizabeth had four children, her younger children, they've taken different routes, and Prince Harry, he's taken a different route as well, too.
Science writer Andrew Vizekas, the night sky guy, on artificial intelligence helping in space exploration.
The big news is applying artificial intelligence techniques to search the cosmos for extraterrestrial life. And I think this is so amazing. It's a great use of this technology. We hear so much about AI. People are frightened about it, questioning the technology, but here it's really being put to good use. Basically, searching that proverbial cosmic haystack and looking for that little needle, in this case, that needle being a sign of a technologically advanced civilization, a radio signal from an alien.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0703 was Lori Knight, a Stuff File Program listener in Northern California. She's also a licensed animal technician. She loves to bake and can preserves and has a soft spot for hairless cats. Thank you very much, Lori, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff. The Super Bowl is upcoming, but let me take you back a couple of years to share a story about a certain Philadelphia Eagles fan. Jigar Desai is a big fan of the Eagles. He became internet famous when, before their 38-7 win over the Minnesota Vikings in the NFC Championship, which led to them winning Super Bowl 52, he was celebrating his team on a subway platform on his way to the game when a train pulled out. Desai ran alongside until he slammed face first into a pillar and then fell onto the moving train. He was uninjured. It was a clean hit, he said, and he admitted he had been drinking. Well, the Eagles are Super Bowl bound again, so Desai, who works for a pharmaceutical company, is now 47 years old and should really know better, says he must run face first into a pillar before every Eagles playoff game, the same pillar if he's near the station. It's working, he said. Let's not mess with a good thing. Wow. I know he works for a drug company, but seriously, drugs must be involved. This says a lot about NFL culture. Winning depends on embracing multiple concussions. Yeah. 68-year-old Musa Hasaya Kasera has a problem, but he admits it stems from his own irresponsibility. The Eastern Ugandan man has 12 wives, 102 children, and 578 grandkids. At first it was a joke, he said, but now this has its problems. Two of my wives left because I could not afford the basics like food, education, and clothing. Most of the family live in a house with a rusted corrugated iron roof on a mere 2 acres of land. Kasera can only remember the name of his first and last born, but some of his children's names he can't recall. Now his wives are using contraception. Really? They're using contraception now? Oh, Lord, there is no door on that barn. Anyway, Kasera says, I have learnt from my irresponsible act of producing so many children that I can't look after.
We're going to play a wonderful game called Who is My Daddy and What Does He Do?
Oh, I think we all know what Daddy does. Anyway, a human penis, independent from its owner, was found in an Alabama gas station. Witnesses discovered the dismembered member in a Mobile, Alabama parking lot, but officers with the Mobile Police Department believe the penis belongs to a 29-year-old motorcycle rider who was involved in a fatal and evidently brutal accident nearby. According to police, the preliminary investigation revealed that the victim was riding his motorcycle southbound on the I-65 ramp when he lost control. The rider was thrown from his motorcycle and struck by multiple vehicles. How hard would he have to have been hit for his penis to travel unaccompanied to a nearby gas station parking lot?
Let's free Willy!
Maybe not. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, a Japanese YouTuber created a custom setup to allow his pet fish to play Pokemon on his Nintendo Switch. But a malfunction led to the fish spending money at the eShop and revealing its owner's credit card information on live stream. The betta fish controls the game by swimming to different areas of its tank, which have been outfitted with sensors that simulate pushing the buttons. YouTuber Mutakamiro, aka Maurice, set up the system to live stream the fish playing Pokemon. But a malfunction during gameplay led to the Nintendo Switch returning to its home screen. From the home screen, the fish's movements caused the Nintendo eShop to open and the pet spent its owner's money to buy points. The fish also revealed Maurice's credit card information on the live stream. Maurice said he reached out to Nintendo to explain the unusual incident and the company refunded the money spent by the aquatic gamer.
Parental controls are available as needed, along with the Nintendo Switch Parental Controls mobile app.
Can you really be a parent of a fish? Sounds fishy to me.
If you're dedicated to handheld play, well, so is the sleek, lightweight Nintendo Switch Lite system.
Nope, I'll pass. Besides, my fish is outdoors riding his bicycle. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Vic Ferrari is a retired New York City Police Department detective. He's the author of NYPD Law and Disorder, a humorous behind-the-scenes look into the police department that he worked at. Vic joins us via Zoom from Florida. Hi, Vic.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you so much for having me on your show today. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, this is not the first book you've written. You've written others as well, have you not?
Yeah, that's correct. I've written six, but four of which are NYPD themed, a humorous behind the scenes look of the characters and criminals and the procedures of the New York City Police Department.
At what point did you finally decide, you know, I've got so many stories here, I need to write a book, never mind several books? Was this something that you figured out while you were still a police officer, or did this come later?
No, I was bored out of my mind. I retired. I moved down to Florida. I went through some training. I became a police officer down in Florida for a short period of time. And that didn't work out. It's totally night and day between New York and Florida. Like down here, I had to spend a half a day learning how to wrestle alligators. I said, no, you know what? I could deal with criminals all day long. I'm not gay to wrestling. I retired again. And it was out of necessity. I was bored out of my mind. And friends and family at their urging said, you got all these stories. Why don't you start writing them down? And I did. And, you know, it's led to a little cottage industry for me.
How long were you on the NYPD?
I did 20 years almost to the day.
And when you decided to start writing these stories, did you hear any feedback or even pushback from some of your former colleagues or some of your superiors?
That's a great question. I was terrified of that. I didn't want pushback or blowback. I mean, most of my friends and family, you know, are on the department. But I said, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. I didn't want to get anybody divorced or in trouble. So I changed the names, the dates, the locations and times. But these incidents have happened. And surprisingly, after my book started getting published, the feedback was positive. And then all of a sudden, the people that I thought were going to be my biggest critics are calling me up, feeding me more stories. Like, you should have written about this guy and remember when this happened. So actually, it turned out to be a pleasant experience.
So give us an idea of some of the stories you have within the pages of NYPD Law and Disorder.
Sure. So there's different chapters. All my books are short stories. There's a theme. So from Law and Disorder, you have things that go wrong, embarrassing moments. Like, there's a story in there. There was a cop that we knew that he wasn't the brightest of people. And he went out one night and he didn't want to bring his gun with him. So he hid his gun in the one place he didn't think anybody would look, which was his oven. Goes out, has a couple of cocktails, comes back 4 hours, 9 beers later. He's hungry. He decides to preheat his oven to 425 to make some frozen pizzas. He goes into his living room. He starts channel surfing on the television. And the next thing you know, his gun, the rounds in his gun, because the heat started exploding. So probably the first round, he was like, oh, wow, what was that? And by the second one, he was crawling out of his house, calling 911 on himself because his gun had exploded in the oven.
Now, did he realize at that point when he made the call that that's what happened? Or did he think someone was actually shooting at him?
No, he realized his error. And, you know, it was funny because in the NYPD, the quickest way to get in trouble is to lose your gun, your shield, or your police identification. Usually you'll lose 30 vacation days and they'll put you on a year probation. So, I mean, he did this to not lose his firearm. And what wound up happening is he lost 30 vacation days and got put on a year of probation.
Well, speaking of firearms, I saw a little blurb about your book, and it made me think about something. When police officers go to the bathroom, you have to take your gun belt off and usually hang it on a hook, and that can be problematic.
Yeah, and that's the opening chapter of NYPD Law and Disorder. I was in a public men's room. I had to use the bathroom. I hung my gun. I dropped my pants to the ground and hung my gun belt on the hook, and it was in the Bronx. A bunch of teenagers ran into the bathroom. They were roughhousing, and then it got quiet. The next thing I know, one of the teenagers ran into the next stall, jumped on top of the toilet seat, and was trying to grab my gun. So I jumped up with one hand trying to pull my pants up. The other hand, I grabbed him around the neck, and now it's a hockey fight. I had to let go of my pants to the ground. His friends run into the next stall. They're pulling his legs. It's a tug of war. Finally, the young man let go of my gun belt. It hits the floor like a fumble. I let go of him. He goes back over the wall. I pull up my pants. I put on my gun belt, and I ran into the food court of this little shopping mall, and they were gone.
How many of the stories, or do many of the stories within your pages actually involve you, or are they stories about other police officers, like the guy who was trying to deep fry his gun?
It's a mix. I mean, some of them I am involved in. Others, it's just, you know, legendary stories that happened around the department.
When you look back at these stories, because, you know, I'm sure when you work as a police detective, not all days are sunshine and roses. But do you look back at these stories with a sense of fun, a sense of pride? Do these stories balance out some of the more tragic things you had to deal with as a police officer?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you got to take the good with the bad. And if you work in law enforcement, you want to be successful, you have to be able to compartmentalize things and not take it home with you. You know, you have to deal with it at work and say, okay, it's over. I'm fine. He's fine. She's fine. Let's move on.
You've done, as I mentioned, several books now. Do you feel you have other books within you? Do you feel that there are still more stories you need to tell?
Oh, absolutely. Right now I'm working on my seventh. I'm about 200 pages in, probably about 20 pages from now. I'll begin the editing process. I don't have a title for it yet. I think I've got one or two more NYPD themed books, and then I'll probably move on to writing about something else.
Tell us the story about the kiss-ass cop that went out to get the chief's lunch.
Yeah, I was working in organized crime at the time. It's probably the mid-2000s. It was myself and several detectives. We were in plain clothes. We were in this deli in the Bronx, and it was a great lunch place. It's one of these places. It's like where the Soup Nazi used to be in lower Manhattan, in Midtown. There's a line of people waiting to get food in this place. And we were in this deli. We were about halfway in. And a friend of my brother's, who was also a policeman, comes in uniform, and he recognizes me. He attempts to cut the line. And I says, "No, listen," I says, "you're going to start a riot in here. I mean, you got a lot of hungry people." And he's like, "Well, you know, he worked in the borough, which is where all the chiefs work." And he goes, "Well, I'm here to get the chief's lunch. And, you know, I hate to pull rank." I go, "Rank? It's just, you're a cop. I'm a detective. Get out of here." And people on the line saw what he was trying to do, even though he was in uniform. And the Bronx would be a rough place. And you had construction workers and you know, telephone company repairmen, little old ladies. And they're like, "Yeah, get out of here. Get off. Get to the back of the line. Get out of here. What are you doing, butthead?" And the next thing you know, they shamed him and he got to the back of the line. He went outside the restaurant and waited outside.
Now, you mentioned when you moved to Florida, you started working with a police department there, and you realized that it was very, very different from what you had been accustomed to in New York. Is New York policing just a different breed all to its own?
It's totally different. Well, when you work for a large city, there's a lot more problems, and the problems are different, and you're dealing with different ethnicities. It's totally different. In Florida, it's more like Mayberry. I mean, for the department I worked with, you know what I mean? Like Otis the drunk, and you know, you're kind of running into the same people all the time. Whereas in New York, you may never see anybody again, and you're in the same precinct.
Now that you've written all these books and you say you have another one in you, maybe even more than one, the next logical step would be turning some of your stories into either a movie or a television series. Is that something on your horizon?
Oh, yes. From your lips to God's ears. And if anybody in Hollywood is listening, I'd love for you to option my books. Yeah, that would be great for me.
When you were a police officer and you were accumulating these stories, did you ever think, wow, maybe I should write these into a book, but some of these stories are just unbelievable. Like what was one of the things that happened to you as a police officer that you said, no one's going to believe this?
Oh, all the time. It's so funny you should say that. Like I would come home and tell my parents or my girlfriend something that happened. They're like, come on. I'm like, I'm serious. You know, I mean, in the opening story to NYPD's Flying Circus, Cops, Crime, and Chaos, my partner and I get called out to a short stay motel. And the call was for a noise complaint. So we step outside. We're outside this door in this motel. And just before I knock on the door with my nightstick, I hear an old lady scream something in the throes of passion. I can't really say what it is, but if you buy the book, it's in the opening chapter. So my partner and I start laughing because it's apparent that there's two old people and they're having sex. So we knock on the door anyway. This little old man opens the door in a pair of boxer shorts. He's a nervous wreck. And I'm like, listen, I'm sorry to bother you. I says, we just want to come in and make sure you're okay. So he lets us in. I just wanted to make sure no one was abducted, you know? So I walked in the little motel room. I went to the walked into the bathroom. No one's there. Granny's laying in bed. She's got to be 80 something years old with a comforter pulled up to her eyes. And they were carrying on so much that there was multiple 911 calls there. I was like, okay, carry on. And we left.
Oh, the fit of passion knows no age.
You got that right. And the fact that the two of them had to go to a short stay motel.
Yes, exactly. Well, maybe they had, you know, grandchildren at home in their respective places where they couldn't make the same noise.
They were married.
Anyway, Vic, it's a fascinating concept for a book, for several books. The latest one is NYPD Law and Disorder. Vic, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Retired NYPD detective Vic Ferrari, author of NYPD Law and Disorder. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0703, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
There's still more guests, more news, and an idiot of the day coming your way on The Stuff File program. Stay tuned. The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program. Good times start here. Where they end up depends on how good your legal team is. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about what's going on in the royal family. It's making all the tabloid news these days. Plus, Andrew Vizekas, the night sky guy, is back on the program to talk about AI in space. We also have an idiot of the day and more Stuff File news right here, right now, here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. You know, Americans are, for the most part, lovely people, but the problem is they sometimes let the wrong ones out of their country and it taints their image. So, we have another episode of Americans Abroad. First up, 34-year-old American animal rights activist Alicia Day was arrested in Moscow, Russia on February the 1st after she paraded a calf through Red Square shouting, "Animals are not food!" In a Russian court, she was fined 20,000 rubles, which is about $285 US, and sentenced to 13 days of administrative arrest. I wonder what they're feeding her during that time. Anyway, although Day is in Russia on a tourist visa, she explained in court that she had a driver bring the calf to Red Square so she could, quote, "show it a beautiful place in our beautiful country," unquote. Yeah, I got nothing to add to that. Meanwhile, a 34-year-old California man was arrested in Florence, Italy on January 26th after he drove his rented Fiat onto the Ponte Vecchio, a stone bridge dating back to 1345 that spans the Arno River and is now a pedestrian walkway and shopping destination. The unnamed driver told police he couldn't find parking and didn't realize he was on the historic bridge. He was fined about 500 euros. Well, that's a pretty hefty toll. And full disclosure, I love chicken wings. I could eat them every day in large quantities if I allow myself. As a matter of fact, I had chicken wings just before I started this show. Anyway, I do, however, have my limits, and as a result, there is no such thing as a bottomless pit of wings, even if that was something that I secretly dream about. So, I'm baffled by this next story. During the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, when students in Harvey, Illinois School District 152 were learning remotely, the district provided meals that families could pick up. 66-year-old social worker Vera Lydell allegedly helped herself to some of that food. To be specific, 11,000 cases of chicken wings. Lydell worked for the district for more than a decade. A business manager uncovered the plot during a routine audit, finding individual invoices signed by Lydell for massive quantities of chicken wings, an item, by the way, that was never served to students because they contained bones. Lydell would place the order, then pick up the food in a district van. They didn't reveal what Lydell did with the $1.5 million worth of chicken wings. She was charged with theft. So, I'm assuming that she's not going to be flying the coop anytime soon. An unnamed 27-year-old man was arrested on January 27th in Seattle after a homeowner returned to her house to find him in her bathtub filling the tub with water. When police arrived, they discovered a smashed window and the burglar inside, clothed but very wet, and the bathtub was full. The intruder would not provide a motive for his strange break-in and was charged with residential burglary. So, I'm assuming that he didn't make a clean getaway. A Seattle, Washington resident with home surveillance spotted someone bundling a body into a vehicle and driving off, so he informed the police, who sent a SWAT team into the man's house. The man said he'd taken the apparently lifeless body to a hospital because it was actually a living woman suffering a drug overdose, and at some point the hospital did confirm that the woman in question was there, alive. This was not sufficient to get her rescuer out of trouble, however. He had a warrant out for him for robbery, and that was what he was booked on. So the moral of this story is, be careful saving people if you've got a warrant out for you. Or better yet, just call an ambulance. And finally in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, there doesn't seem to be any good news out of Russia these days. And here's a recent story that kind of exemplifies that. Passengers aboard a charter flight on January the 8th from the Siberian city of Magan, Russia, where, by the way, it was 41 degrees below zero on the ground, had to brave even more extreme temperatures when the rear door of the plane flew off in mid-flight. Said passenger Sergei Lidrick, people had their hats blown off. One man had just unfastened his seatbelt when the door blew open and he was nearly sucked out along with the luggage and other personal belongings. The plane, an Antonov AN-26, was manufactured between 1970 and 1986. The pilot turned back to Magan and made an emergency landing, and there were no injuries. You know, if I was an American late-night talk show host, right about now, I'd be making a joke about Spirit Airlines, but I won't do that. Instead, I'll just go to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Let's do it. Back when Queen Elizabeth died in September, we spoke to journalist Alan Eustack about the future of the monarchy. Well, it's been almost a half a year, so I thought we would tackle the monarchy from a different angle with a different person. Peter McNally is a professor emeritus at the School of Information Studies and the director of the History of McGill Project. He also considers himself a self-proclaimed palace watcher. He joins us via Zoom from right here in Montreal. Hello, Professor McNally.
Hi, Peter. Great to be here today.
Thanks for being on the program with us. We are watching this whole thing unfold about the monarchy in real time because the British press is relentless to a certain degree, and the gossip columnists are out because they see a rift in the palace or a malice in the palace, and they heighten all of this. Your thoughts on the whole situation, first of all, with the battle between William and Harry, the heir and the spare, which, by the way, spare is the title of Harry's book. Your thoughts in general on that?
There are so many thoughts. Where do you begin? Where do you stop with the whole thing? First of all, is there really a battle between them? And I'm not really sure that there is so much. There's obviously friction between them. They've taken different paths. Whether it's actually gotten to the point of being a battle, I'm not really quite sure. We have two sons, one who is first in line of succession to the throne. He's the new Prince of Wales. He will, in the course of time, become king. And we know what his destiny is. The problem is, of course, is that the younger children, Queen Elizabeth had four children, her younger children, well, Anne, Andrew, and Edward, they've taken different routes. And Prince Harry, well, he's taken a different route as well, too. Prince Harry was certainly offered status within the royal family. The late Queen Elizabeth II, she had made him a special ambassador to the Commonwealth. And he and his wife, Megan, the Duchess of Sussex, this was going to be a primary role for them, particularly dealing with African, Asian, Caribbean countries, where, frankly, most of the 2.5 billion people of the Commonwealth live. They have chosen a different route. It's quite clear that Prince William feels let down by this. He feels that he was counting upon Harry to be there in support of him. Harry feels that, on the other hand, that William was unsupportive of him in marrying Meghan and in wanting to make a different lifestyle for himself. Well, you know, brothers everywhere can have issues like this. But I know that King Charles, our new king, is trying very, very hard to make a reconciliation between them. And Harry himself has said that the day of Prince Philip's funeral, Prince Charles, King Charles, said to his two sons, please do not make my final years a misery. Please work together. And I know he's making every effort to do so. The king apparently is trying to work out a way to make sure that Harry attends the coronation. And I think that he is attempting reconciliation. But, you know, I had an older brother. Our relationship at various times wasn't always great. But in the end, I think we reconciled and we appreciated the fact that we had this bond between us. And let's hope the same happens with William and Harry.
Well, as I said earlier, part of the situation is the social media, is the press. I'm just wondering, I mean, is this anything really new? And by that, I mean situations between the heir and the spare. Would this have been any different with today's social media and press between Elizabeth and Margaret?
Well, I think if you look at the at any family, you know, sibling rivalries are just part of what it's all about. Of course, with the monarchy, with the British aristocracy and the peerage in general, where you do have primogeniture, this is the eldest son and now the eldest daughter, taking priority over everybody else, inheriting the title, the position, most of the family fortune. Of course, this is going to be an issue. But it doesn't have to always be like this. With the monarchy, it's a little bit different. Back in 1936, when King Edward VIII abdicated to marry Mrs. Simpson, and he became the Duke of Windsor, there was tension between him and his younger brother, who then became King George VI. And the problem there was is that there was an issue, particularly in the late 30s with World War II, where was the focus of loyalty going to be? And I think there was some fear on the part of the new King George VI that his brother, although he had abdicated, was somehow going to try to assume some sense of authority over him. And that was a point of issue. Between, on the other hand, between the Queen and her younger sister, Princess Margaret, Princess Margaret, I don't think ever showed any disloyalty to the Queen. She was always completely loyal to her. The problem for Princess Margaret was she was not able to find a real role and a life for herself. What Prince Harry is trying to do is make a separate life for himself that's going to be separate from the monarchy, it would seem. But what he always doing it is through going to Hollywood and becoming a celebrity. And what I find difficult here is that he said he was leaving England because he couldn't bear the scrutiny of the media, of the London tabloids. But yet, where did he go? Well, he's gone to Hollywood. He has interviews with Oprah Winfrey and with Corbett on late night television. And so he's taken the psychotherapeutic route, and he's sort of bearing his inner soul, his psychological stress, his existential crisis. It's not a very British way of doing things. It's not a way that the royal family feels comfortable with. That's a long answer to a short question, Peter, but that's my view of it.
But I'm going to stick up a little bit for Harry here in that there's a whole difference between the British press, Fleet Street, and what they will do, and the press that Harry is talking to in the United States as of now.
So far, the American press, you're quite right, has been reasonably sympathetic. Not entirely, but they've been more sympathetic. But remember, American society is more used to the idea of celebrity and of celebrity soul bearing and spilling it all out. And this appeals to the American sensibility in a way it does not appeal to the British sensibility.
But when I'm talking about the difference between the two presses, I'm not talking about whether they're sympathetic or not. I'm just talking about some of the underhanded things that we know the British press have done.
Oh, yes, you're quite right. The British tabloid press is ruthless, and they'll go in for telephone tapping. They'll go in for all sorts of things of this sort. On the other hand, social media, it doesn't matter whether it's in Canada, the States, or Britain, is just generally a pretty mean sort of thing. This is a problem not only for Harry and Meghan, it's a problem for you and me and everybody else as well, too. But yeah, you're right. The British tabloid press, oh no, it's a vicious thing.
And again, when I make the analogy between Prince Harry and Princess Margaret, I'm not talking about the role they have within the monarchy. I'm more concerned about the role they were not allowed to have in their personal lives.
Well, that's a big problem. And but partly that just reflected, of course, the British reality. When Princess Margaret in the 1950s was attempting to have a marriage or a relationship with Peter Townsend, the British notion about things was different, as it was in Canada. Remember, in the 1950s here in Canada, divorce was very uncommon. Here in Quebec, it was virtually impossible. You had to have an act of parliament if you were living in Quebec to have a divorce. That was the situation in Britain as well, too. The idea of a princess marrying a divorced man, etc., who had been basically her father's aide de camp, was considered to be impossible. Now, of course, the idea of King Charles and Queen Camilla having married, Charles having divorced, his wife dead, but Camilla's former husband still being alive, that was possible. So the world has changed in some ways, and poor Princess Margaret suffered as a result.
Do you think that, speaking about the king and queen consort Camilla, do you think part of the issue was the fact that this was a love that he always had? And just like everyone else within the royal family, it seems to be, when the monarch decides, because the monarch is not only a mother or a sister, the monarch is also the head of the Church of England. And when it's kind of decided that, no, you won't marry this particular person, you have to find someone else. Isn't that part of the problem that Prince Charles had at the time, that he was always in love with Camilla?
Well, yeah, but, you know, many of us, when we were young, we were in love with a lot of people, and things did change. Remember, it's more than just the Queen or now the King Charles being head of the Church of England. There's also, remember, the Royal Succession Act. These people who are so close to the monarchy in terms of the succession, by law, have to go to the Queen, or now King Charles, and ask for permission to marry. And this is official. And the Queen may very well end up discussing it with the government. With Princess Margaret, remember, part of the problem was less the Queen's attitude towards her sister than it was the government's attitude. And remember, Queen Elizabeth II and her son, King Charles III, are constitutional monarchs, and they act on advice, political and legal advice. And the political advice that Queen Elizabeth II received about the marriage of her sister, Princess Margaret, in the 1950s, was that Princess Margaret, if she married Peter Townsend, would have to give up her status as a princess. She would also have to give up her allowance as a princess. And that was a government decision. Now, in the case of in the 21st century, in our era, the attitudes have changed significantly. Now, as far as Charles and Camilla were concerned, it was obvious when they were younger, they were in love. But, you know, he was going off to sea for 12 months, and she saw somebody else, and she married him. I think it was only later that they both appreciated the strength of their relationship. However, King Charles has insisted that when he married Lady Diana Spencer, that he had made a decision that this would be a successful marriage, and that he was committed to her. and that he stayed committed to her until after the birth of Prince Harry, when it became obvious to him that the marriage had broken down, that they simply were incompatible. Now, I'm not a psychotherapist. I'm not a psychoanalyst. So I can't go any further than that. But I think you have to give the king at least the benefit of the doubt and say that if he went into the marriage in good faith, that he did so.
We've got less than a minute, so I just ask this one very quick question. Do you think the monarchy is in good hands for the future?
I think that King Charles is a very good king, but let's face it, his style of being a king will be different from that of Queen Elizabeth II. He is committed, that he is responsible, that he takes the job of being a constitutional monarch and head of the Commonwealth very, very seriously, that he's basically a very decent man, intelligent. His commitment to such issues as environment, I think, are very commendable. I think we have an obligation to give him the benefit of the doubt, because I think that he is committed to doing the best job possible.
Peter McNally, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Peter McNally, Professor Emeritus at the School of Information Studies, Director of the History of McGill Project, and a self-proclaimed palace watcher. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Here's a brief word about our show and my book. If you become a regular Patreon patron of the Stuff File program, I'll give you an e-version of my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. It's easy to do. Just go to patreon.com and become a patron to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. So, join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Sign up at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy, is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky, and also National Geographic's Stargazer's Atlas, the ultimate guide to the night sky. And Andrew, it seems that AI is all over the news these days, including when it comes to space exploration.
Yeah, I mean, the big news, obviously, here is applying artificial intelligence techniques to search the cosmos for extraterrestrial life. And I think this is so amazing. It's a great use of this technology. We hear so much about AI. People are frightened about it, questioning the technology, but here it's really being put to good use in basically searching that proverbial haystack, cosmic haystack, and looking for that little needle, in this case, that needle being a sign of a technologically advanced civilization, a radio signal from an alien, potentially. And artificial intelligence here is basically looking, using a computer that is basically streamlining the search for ETs, using this new algorithm that basically organizes existing radio data from looking at stars out in the cosmos, in the Milky Way galaxy specifically, and in our neighborhood, our little part of the Milky Way galaxy, and looking for these signals, radio signals from technologically advanced civilizations. And it's allowing astronomers to distinguish between real signals, real potential signals that are coming from beyond the solar system, from interference. Basically, things human-caused radio interference. Part of what really draws astronomers to listen using radio telescopes in the cosmos is that it can travel unimpeded for many, many light years across the cosmos. We can actually listen to radio waves from galaxies that are literally millions and millions of light years away. And we can also obviously hear signals that are relatively nearby, maybe some stars like in this particular study that was announced this week, you know, some things that are maybe 30 to 100 light years away, which is just in our neighborhood. And the same reason that why it's so advantageous for astronomers to look at radio signals in the search for ETs, it's the same reason why humans are using it so much, because it's just so easy and it travels in very strong signals very easily around the world and unimpeded. That's why there's a lot of interference, as expected, that we ourselves cause in this environment we live in our part of the cosmos. In fact, we've been pumping out radio waves for many, many decades, and we're a very strong source of those radio waves. So as a result, telescopes listening into the cosmos have to deal with a lot of interference. And this has been a huge problem in terms of picking and choosing, kind of teasing out real signals from other stars to things that are just, you know, picking up cell phone, you know, waves that we have here. So creating what we call false positives, signals. And so this new artificial intelligence algorithm techniques allows us to basically accelerate that search for ETs. And in fact, this very first pass of existing data, they had basically hundreds of thousands of existing data from different parts of the universe, and they poured through that data set using this artificial intelligence technique, and the computer was able to pick out a handful of signals that we know are not from the Earth environment. So they're not caused by humans. They are most likely from these distant stars between 30 to 100 light years away. We don't know if they are, extraterrestrial intelligence indeed. We don't know that for sure. They've tested it, by the way. They went back with their radio telescopes to listen in on these stars, and they couldn't replicate the signals that were first detected before a couple of years ago. But what they do know is that this new AI technique was able to really quickly identify these truly cosmic sources of radio waves. So they're really excited about this now, Peter, because this could really speed up finding potential candidate radio signals much more quickly. And then we can zero in on those places and just focus on listening on those few candidate sites.
Well, you know, there are a lot of conspiracy theories out there about people who don't like AI. So let me just toss another one onto the fire here, because I can just see where this is going to go. You know, you're going to get some corners of the world out there that are going to say, well, now you're going to have computers and machines talking to other alien machines. And maybe those machines will band together and fight against us because, you know, it's machine talking to machine and we're going to be wiped out.
Yeah. And in this case, I don't think we have to worry because it is humans controlling everything. It's basically humans feeding the information and taking out the information from these computers. So it's not really computers doing anything. The computers don't have the ability to be connected to radio telescopes and do the actual, they're not actually projecting signals out, pumping out signals. Literally, it's just listening to the cosmos and hearing different little pings of radio pings out there and trying to distinguish what's causing those things. Is it an artificial source or is it a natural source? And that's really what the computers are trying to help in that, in streamlining that process.
Well, let's continue with my favorite Armageddon-based theory, and that is Bennu's coming, or the precursor to Bennu. The recent arrival of asteroid 2023 BU, apparently this is the fourth closest asteroid that is zipped by us. This is just a trailer.
Yeah.
To an upcoming show that maybe we don't want.
Yes, Bennu. Yes. Bennu, for those of you who are not familiar, is this asteroid that is going to make probably a very close brush past the Earth-Moon system in a few years' time. And we're watching that system. But, I mean, no worries. We're just going to have a great ringside show for that. I think no worries. I know, Peter, you're still worried about it, but I wouldn't be. But we're going to keep an eye on it. But in the meantime, there was this asteroid that now is really a record setter, and that is the fourth closest pass to our planet at only 3,600 kilometers. It's really incredible.
And by the way, when you talk about how close it is actually closer to us than some of our satellites.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. That's what makes it so incredible in terms of that distance. I mean, it's 3,600 kilometers sounds like a lot, but it's not. It's really very close. Most of the geosynchronous satellites that we have up there that are used for communication in many respects, like telecommunication satellites, they're sitting about 36,000 kilometers above our heads. And this rock, basically the size of a box truck, zoomed past us on January 26th at only 3,600 kilometers. That's 2,200 miles. Really incredible. What was even more incredible is that folks on the ground, amateur astronomers, were able to watch this asteroid zip past the star fields very, very quickly. It was really impressive. Of course, a lot of professional observatories were watching too, trying to predict its trajectory. And in fact, this small rock was following Earth's orbit, mimicking Earth's orbit for a number of years potentially. But this encounter has really changed the orbit of this asteroid now permanently. In fact, now it's in a looping orbit because of the gravitational pull of the Earth. It kind of created this slingshot effect with the small rock. And now it's in an orbit that was before about 366 days for it to make one loop around the sun. Now it's 425 days for it to make one loop, and it's an elongated loop that now sends it out, or will be sending it out in the next few months, all the way out to almost practically to Mars. And so are we going to have more encounters with this rock? Probably not, because it's changed its orbit. But it's a really great primer for astronomers to, you know, be able to get a good handle on what asteroids, how to watch asteroids when they make close approaches to our planet, because there are a lot. And Peter, we think there are literally thousands of these small truck-sized asteroids that are orbiting our planet. We're just not able to see them until they're literally on top of us. That's what happened. This asteroid was found only 5 days before its close encounter with us.
My jokes about Bennu aside, there is a real danger here. And that I'm thinking about the fact that these things are actually lower than our satellites. So I'm not overly concerned about the Earth, because in most cases, these things that are truck size will burn up before they get into the ground. But that being said, how dangerous are they to satellites that they could just obliterate?
Oh, yeah.
Or the space station.
Yeah, I mean, we don't even have to talk about something the size of a truck. You can take a grain of sand-sized rock, just a grain of sand size. If it's traveling at crazy speeds like this asteroid does, we're talking like 60,000 to 100,000 kilometers per hour. Something like that, it just literally just goes like a knife through butter when it hits a satellite panel or a space station outer hull shell of a habitat module. It can really wreak havoc, these particles out there. And yes, if it's large enough, if we're talking about something that's maybe the size of a baseball or a sofa or a refrigerator-sized rock, they can pulverize a satellite potentially, create a huge shrapnel cloud that now, you know, orbits the Earth, and anything in that shrapnel cloud's range, it could really, really wreak damage, and it could create a cascade of effect. Very similar to that movie, Peter, that called Gravity, if you remember,
right,
with Sandra Bullock. Very well represented, by the way. Many astronauts watched that movie and said that scenario can very well happen, where you have a chain reaction of one satellite being destroyed with another one and another one, cause, you know, each one getting worse, and the shrapnel cloud just growing larger. And then basically you have basically a no man land, a no-go zone around the Earth of not being able to put satellites in certain parts that are polluted. So yes, these kind of space rocks can potentially cause a lot of problems. And that's why it's so important for us to be able to know where they are and, you know, what their trajectories are.
And we're out of time. So you want to go to Patreon?
Yeah, let's do it. There's so much more to talk about.
Let's do that. Speak to you there.
Clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy, and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky, and also the new National Geographic's Stargazer's Atlas, the ultimate guide to the night sky. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0703, and you can find links to Andrew's site to get your own personal autographed copy. And Patreon subscribers, you can hear more of Andrew as a Patreon reward extra, where we'll discuss NASA's work on a nuclear rocket, a SpaceX test firing, a private company's moon lander, and more. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And now, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A fingerprint on a Corona Light beer bottle helped convict a man of robbery in South Jersey. 38-year-old Courtney Bell was convicted by a jury on January 31st. The investigation began in July of 2019 after police were called to a TD Bank for a report of a robbery. Upon arrival, employees and customers indicated a man came into the bank wearing a hooded sweatshirt, bandana, sunglasses, and dirty sweat socks on his hands. He approached a teller with his hand in his pocket, pointing toward her, saying he had a gun. He threatened to start shooting the tellers unless they provided him with money. He was given a few bundles of cash, which he dropped on the floor while attempting to exit the bank. As he was picking up the fallen currency, a Corona Light beer bottle fell out of his pocket. He fled the bank with $600. Investigators took the bottle to the New Jersey State Police Central Regional Laboratory, where forensic scientists were able to obtain a DNA sample that was ultimately matched to Bell. He was charged with the bank robbery in December of 2020. And get this, the warrant was served to him in the Burlington County Jail, where he was awaiting trial for a separate offense. Now why? Oh, why? If you go to the trouble of wearing dirty sweat socks on your hands to avoid leaving prints, would you leave behind a beer bottle which clearly have your prints and your DNA on them? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0703. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0703. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including kdxradio.com, truetalkradio.com, over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, WLSLLPFM in Dade City, Florida, KZZHLPFM in Eureka, California, CKUWFM in Winnipeg, CFMU in Hamilton, CKLU in Sudbury, Local 107.3 FM in St. John, CHSR in Fredericton, and also streaming on just about any streaming service your little heart desires. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Peter is a man who came from very meager beginnings, and he's continued to go downhill from there.